Yeah, you can smell the pot, you can smell the sweat, you can smell the booze. Yeah.
You can smell the vomit in the aisles.
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater, a priestly look at some of your favorite musicals, with your hosts, cathedral deans and musical theater queens, Nathan LaRude and Peter Elliott.
It's the Gospel of Musical Theater. My name is Nathan.
I'm Peter, and so A Star Is Born.
A Star Is Born.
This is a kind of hinge point, I think, for Streisand.
Yeah.
This is, she's no longer Dolly Levi. She's not Fanny
Bryce. No, she's
definitely
not Dolly Levi. There are no Victorian gowns. There's
Although all her clothes in the film, as it says in the credits at the end, from the closet of Miss Streisand.
Which she caught so much hell for, and she doesn't really understand why people find that so, like, I mean, there's a way in which the way that Barbara tries to defend this film, to me, indicates, like, all of the ways in which she really doesn't understand why people find her so campy. And some of it's the she's like, well, why shouldn't I use my own clothes? And at one level, why shouldn't she? Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Good for you. And another level, like, the credit is a little bit weird, you know? Like, it is a little strange to sort of show off the fact that everything you wore in this film, you just pulled out of your closet. I mean, I suppose it's a way of saying it creates a myth around A Star Is Born that I think she's trying to push back on in her autobiography, right? This is a film. It's not my real life. It's never my real life. I am playing a character. I work really hard to make a piece of art that has nothing necessarily to do with me, Barbra Streisand, the person. But when your credit at the end of the film is all of Miss Streisand's clothes are from her own closet, and the film is so clearly deeply personal about her. My sense is her and John Peters and kind of putting their dysfunctional relationship on screen. How can you not draw all the connecting lines that people have drawn about, you know, for the last 40 years of this, for almost 50 years now of this film's life, that this is sort of Barbra Streisand. It's as the director of the film, Frank Pearson, infamously wrote in a horrible takedown article in the Village Voice, it was a $6 million home movie that she and John Peters filmed, kind of a vanity project. That's the cheap way of scuttling it. Barbara really pushes back on that in the autobiography. Fair, right? Like she says, you know, All the male stars do this, and nobody gets upset for Robert Redford for firing his director and directing a film himself. I do it, and I get in trouble. This is sexism. This is misogyny. This is the patriarchy. Fair. That's a fair critique. And, wow, Barbara, like, the film does feel like a $6 million home movie.
Yeah. And this material, written originally, I think, by Moss Hart.
Well, originally by, like, Dorothy Parker and...
Okay. It has a rich history. And you're more familiar with the history than I am.
Yeah, I went... So my rabbit hole this weekend, my friend, was to watch all of the other A Star Is Borns, which I'd seen before, because when the Bradley Cooper A Star Is Born came out in 2018, I did a project like this where I was like, I want to watch every single one and compare them. which is a really... It's an interesting... You know, so the first Star Is... Actually, technically, the first Star Is Born, I think, is like an late 20s Hollywood. It's called What Price Hollywood? And David O. Selznick worked on it and then kind of turned it around to be the 36, maybe 37, Janet Gaynor, Frederick March, A Star Is Born, which is, I mean, you know, is a 30s melodrama. It's not, you know, it's not a particularly sophisticated film. I don't think Janet Gaynor is at all compelling as a, you know, potential movie star. Like, I don't get what the deal. Frederick March is pretty good. But it kind of sets up the story, right? Young girl moves from North Dakota, wants to make it big, falls in love with a self-destructive actor kind of on the decline of his career. Her career is in the ascendancy. His career is in decline. They meet. They fall in love. He kind of helps her, you know, make it. He gives her big breaks, but then ultimately, like, realizes he's standing in the way of her success. So in both of the early films, the 1937 film and then the Judy Garland film, he walks into the ocean and kills himself. Judy Garland, you know, they remake it in 1956 for Judy Garland. It's her comeback role. She's really good. Obviously, she's Judy Garland. They wrote The Man That Got Away for that film. It's one of her iconic, you know, everybody who knows queer culture knows that scene. Judy Garland in the jazz club, red background. She's in a very simple dress. She sings The Man. She sells The Man That Got Away. It's all one take. It's an incredible moment. The rest of the film is kind of clunky. But there, you know, in 1956, this is where we kind of make a musical out of the story, right? Like, so taking the 30s melodrama, adding music to it, Judy Garland is a singer who's moving to Hollywood, trying to make it big. She meets Oh, what? It's the British alcoholic actor.
James Mason.
James Mason meets James Mason, who is kind of weird in that role, but he, you know, propels her to stardom. At the end of the film, he walks into the ocean. So 1973, right? There's two versions of this story, actually three, that are kind of floating around Hollywood. And Joan Didion and her husband,
John Gregory Dunn,
have written, without having seen, my understanding is without having seen either of their properties, but being familiar enough with the story, which at this point is kind of... It's in the culture. Yeah. It's like Romeo and Juliet. It's a trope. It's a trope that we know. It's destructive man, talented woman. They meet. They fall in love. He's horrible. He's standing in the way of her success. He has to get out of the way. So in some ways, like, what is this? Is this like the fragile male ego? Is this trying to make sense? I mean, my sense is like A Star Is Born is kind of trying to make sense of the women's movement, you know, in the 30s, in the 50s, now in the 70s, in a very obvious way, right? Barbara's very interested in gender norms have changed, marriage has changed, men and women's relationships have changed. So we need to, if we're going to make this story still has power, but it's really got to be about women in a man's world and how men treat her. So she's got a certain kind of proto-feminist agenda in making this film that I think is really important.
Barbara says in her autobiography, 1976, it was the height of the women's liberation movement. I realized I could say something about women through the character of Esther. Yeah. So very intentionally going in. And she was very involved, maybe too involved, in the putting together of this film, including doing the final edit as executive producer. So she had a clear agenda. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a good agenda.
Yeah. And a good agenda. No, my sense is 1976, Janet Gaynor and Judy Garland are basically, they're sort of, caught in the role of the little woman. Never, there's no fights. That was one of the things that she doesn't like about the early films. She's like, there's no fights in any of those films. The women just they just sit there like little soft blankets around these self-destructive men. Their hearts are broken, but they never stand up to them. They never challenge them, right? They're just kind of happy for whatever crumbs of affection they happen to get from these jerks they're married to. And then, at the end of the film, they have this kind of triumphant moment where teary-eyed, they stand in front of an audience and say, I am Mrs. Norman Maine, have their moment of triumph. In some ways, it's like, now Barbara has done that moment, right? Funny Girl ends that way, right? Where she, in some ways, A Star Is Born is kind of the story of Funny Girl. Funny Girl, in an interesting kind of way, is a little bit of a remake of A Star Is Born, right? Very talented woman, meets self-destructive guy. He's good for her till he isn't. She has to basically shed him. But at the end of Funny Girl, she walks out onto a stage, right? Like, we've talked about this when we talked about Funny Girl, that iconic moment with tears in her eyes, right? Where she kind of pays tribute to the fact that he's always going to be a part of her life, but she's ready to move on, which is really kind of, that's the iconic final image of A Star Is Born in all of its versions, from, Janet Gaynor down to Lady Gaga. It's all about a woman with star quality realizing, I'm going to have to do this on my own. He will always be a part of me, but it is time for me to move on. If there's a gospel trajectory in this material, I think that's probably where, right? This is sort of a grief, redemption, paschal mystery sort of a thing, right? Death to resurrection. I realize that this man did horrible things to me. It's a complicated grief. Ultimately left me holding the bag because he kills himself. He takes the easy way out. And it will not defeat me. I am ready to move on into the rest of my life. I will always treasure the time we had, but it's time for me to become a star, right? A Star Is Born. I think that title kind of comes out of that. In the Gaga film, you watched it last night. I watched it last night, too. That final shot where she looks dead into the camera, right? And you get the sense of, this is a fucking star. And then the credits roll, right? This is the price, right? This is the price. Not to put too fine a point on it. This is the price that women pay in this industry to make it big. Now, there is a piece of me that finds that really compelling. There's a piece of me that finds that deeply unsettling.
Yes. Yes, both of them. And I watched the Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper film, which I think, and I think you agree, is a superior film.
It's
at least
I
like
film.
It better than the Kris Kristofferson, Barbara Streisand film.
Of the four Star Is Borns, Barbara's is my least favorite. I find it really tedious. I have to it took me three different settings to get all the way through the film. I just find it so boring. It moves slow. It's clunky. I don't think the music is that good. There are people who love this film. It was a very successful film. I don't want to yuck anybody's yum. If A Star Is Born is your favorite film, I'm so sorry. I do like Barbra Streisand, but oh my God, I don't like this movie. I don't like her in this movie. I just don't think it's a very good film.
Well, it's it picks up the 1970s, and you know, I was just beginning seminary in 1976, lived in the U.S. through the Jimmy Carter years. So this is post Watergate, sort of post Vietnam. Inflation is beginning. It's a very unsettled time. Those of us who were sort of 1950s born, mid 1950s, were awkwardly neither, not quite the baby boomers or too young for Woodstock, you know. But I mean, I always thought of the 70s as kind of a sleazy culture. And it was a culture of, I mean, the world just seemed really fucked up, as it still does, as it always has in my view. There was, I think, an effort to escape from the world, to retreat into kind of hedonistic culture. So that the opening scene, the rock concert in, I think they filmed it in Tempe, Arizona, right? With crane shots and the whole thing. Spent a lot of money on that shot.
Yeah, that's, and, you can smell the
You can smell the pot,
Yeah, you can smell the pot, you can smell the sweat, you can smell the booze.
You can smell the vomit in the aisles.
Okay, folks, the John Norman Howard Speedway!
And then his character, Kris Kristofferson,
John Norman Howard,
John Norman Howard is such an asshole.
He really is.
He really is. The Bradley Cooper version is much more sympathetic.
Yeah, well, they give him a backstory, right? Bradley Cooper's version is the first time in this franchise that you ever get a sense of why this man is this way, which is interesting. Allie is the Esther Hoffman character, played by Lady Gaga in the final installment. She has a little, although she doesn't even have a last name, interestingly, at the end of the film, she's Allie Main because she's married to him. That's sort of their reveal. But before that, she does have a dad. You do get a little bit of a sense of kind of where she's coming from. The franchise begins, 1937, Janet Gaynor gets a whole backstory, right? Like, you see her growing up in North Dakota. She's got a doting grandmother who thinks she can do anything and puts her on a train and sends her to Hollywood to follow her dream. I mean, it really is the Cinderella rags to riches Hollywood story. Anybody can come to this town and make themselves over. She's given a new name. The studio creates a star out of Esther Blodgett is her name. She comes from North Dakota, and then, you know, Hollywood creates her into Vicki Lester. So that's the story that, and then the Judy Garland film basically tells the same story, right? Esther Blodgett becomes Vicki Lester. The Hollywood system does its thing. Barbara's not really that interested. I mean, you know, by 1973, now we're not really telling a Hollywood story anymore. We're telling a story about the music industry. This is about the rock. It's about the rock, rock and roll era, right? So Barbara isn't really all that interested, I don't think, in what Hollywood does to women and to men to make them into stars. She is interested in the destructive culture of fandom.
Yes.
Right? She's interested in celebrity culture and how toxic it is. I mean, she's really got a bone to pick, I think. Fair enough, right? Like, she's had traumatic experiences with crowds mobbing her car. She talks about
Hello Dolly.
Hello Dolly. Yeah, like being afraid that she was going to be killed because she was, you know, like their car was mobbed by fans. And she said, you know, I worked that out with my therapists for years. Like, I still wake up with PTSD moments from that experience. So she has deep trauma, having been at the center of a maelstrom of celebrity-obsessed fans who, you know, wanted adored her, idolized her, wanted something for her. And then she talks about this in the autobiography, right? As soon as you put up a boundary, as soon as you say, no, I'm not going to sing at your party, or no, you can't have an autograph, or I just want to finish my spare ribs, please, they turn on you. They feel like they've paid for you.
Yeah.
And if you push back and become a real person, they snap, and then it becomes violent. And the film really characterizes that, right? Like, Kris Kristofferson punches people out. Actually, every version of this film, all the way down the years, there's some moment where usually it's the man character punches out the fans, right? As a way of, like, pushing back against the way. In the Lady Gaga version, it's Lady Gaga,
it's her,
who comes for them, which I love, that, right? Like, she's the one who punches back. But all of these films really are really interested, I think, in the culture of celebrity, the American culture of pop celebrity. And like, what is that about? And then, you know, really from the perspective of the celebrities themselves, right? There's a way in which this is sounding a cri de coeur from Hollywood, from the music industry. You know, this is what this culture is doing to us. It's causing us to have drinking problems, to do drugs, right? Like, I mean, my sense is the underlying message of this film is the reason these stars are so messed up is because of the price that they are paying in order to be these kinds of mythological idols in people's lives. It is fundamentally destructive, both to the culture and to the screen idols who are put in that role, which is, I mean, kind of right next door to certainly in Hebrew scripture, the prohibition against idols, right? Like, I mean, there's a strong invective throughout the Judeo-Christian tradition, if I can use that problematic term, against idol worship, right? Like, this is toxic. This is toxic when we put human beings in the place of God. And there's a way in which that's exactly what these films are asking us to think about, right? This is destructive. This is demonic in a certain kind of way.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the Streisand Kristofferson film, the Frank Pearson film, really exists on that intersection of celebrity, addiction, feminism, cultural angst, right? And that they all sort of bleed in and out of each other. You know, when you were talking about celebrity, I'm thinking back to Jesus Christ Superstar and the Palm Sunday, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem with Hosanna, Hazanna, and how quickly then the adulation, you know, Hosanna turns into Crucify.
Turns into Crucify, yeah.
And that's the story, weirdly contorted, I think, here. Yeah, and the idolatry that's at the heart of the culture of celebrity. I mean, now, fast forward some 50 years after A Star Is Born, celebrities, regularly when my husband Thomas and I are watching television and somebody comes on, some celebrity who's famous, I say, who is that? I mean, just because I'm old and I don't really get... But there are people who are celebrities.
Okay, boomer.
Just because they're celebrities. That's okay. Yeah. Just because they're celebrities. I mean, as opposed to...
Right. People who are famous for being famous. Yeah.
Famous for being famous.
Like, that has never not been a thing, right? There have always, in human history, right? So some of it is, we're living through a particular time right now with social media and TikTok and blah, 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 where, you know, like, Kim Kardashian is the famous icon of this, right? What did she do? Nothing. She got famous, and now she's famous for being famous. My sense is, like... You trace that all the way back to, like, the 8th century BCE. That's what these prophets are talking about, right? Like, I mean, not literally. There's not a celebrity culture in quite the same way.
They're not talking about Kim Kardashian, but
no,
whatever.
No, Kim Kardashian doesn't exist in the 8th century. But my sense is, like, what they're tapping into is not so much, like, you know, this is weird, this is wrong, but, like, it's the problem is with us, right? The problem is with the culture that projects all of our – I mean, I think what this – one way of – characterizing this phenomenon is its projection, right? So when a celebrity, when Jesus walks into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, the people are projecting all of their hopes and dreams and aspirations on him, right? On one dude. He's going to save us. He's going to be our king. He's going to overthrow the Roman Empire. This is the beginning of the revolution. He's the best thing that ever happened for us. He can save us. And then, right, like when it becomes clear, he's like, yeah, I'm actually not, right? Like, that's not the way the story's going to go. They turn on him. They kill him because now they're projecting on him all of their self-hatred, their fear, their anger. He becomes the scapegoat, right? Like this is, in some ways, this is Girardian mimetic device, right? Like I only know how to desire by watching how the people around me desire. This is imitation. Right. So like that's, I think, I mean, one way of kind of understanding the Girardian sketching of the world is celebrity culture, right? It's all about projection. We project stuff onto other people as a way of kind of testing out our own id, I suppose.
Yeah.
So that can become hugely adulatory or it can become hugely violent. And those two things live right next to each other. We either worship celebrities or we kill them. And those are really the only two options. And all of this is really a function of the crowd, right? This is the crowd projecting our desires onto, we might say, priests of a certain kind. I mean, this, I think, is where, you know, kind of understanding actors, musicians, writers, prophets as, you know, a kind of the sacred role of art. They are the ones who are kind of putting themselves forward to be the projection screens for a culture. And that comes at a cost.
Yeah, because especially musicians, just think of the Streisand and Lady Gaga film, what they do, the muse of musicians is to give energy to this intersection of emotion and melody, right? I mean, and that muse, that ability to produce a sound that penetrates into our souls and our emotions is hugely powerful, always has been, always will be. And the creation of it is, once it becomes a commodity, right? Once it becomes something in the marketplace, bought and sold, and then the escalation of, I need to do more of this so that I can make more money, so that I can support my lifestyle for the celebrities, and then people wanting more and more. You know, it's like, I think in both films, the male character has really run out of material.
Mm-hmm.
And then these women, Streisand, Lady Gaga, bring a whole new life. And, you know, then it's John the Baptist and Jesus. I must decrease, you must increase, you know, the turning all of that into to thing. The other thoughts around idolatry.
Uh-huh.
And I think the word idolatry and addiction, we get into the word sin here, really.
Yeah.
You know, not sin as something bad you're doing, but sin as a state that we all live in.
Right. Yeah. In the Hebrew tradition, I mean, in some ways, idolatry is sort of definitional for sin. Right. I think Christians have turned the word sin into basically a synonym for sex. Right.
Yes.
Like, or desire. That's not really the way that the Hebrew Bible understands sin. It's a much more corporate thing.
Yes.
We're not concerned with individual acts of wrongdoing, but we're more interested in idolatry. Where I think the Hebrew tradition, as I understand it, I don't want to, you know, sketch too broadly here, but if I'm going to paint with real big brushstrokes, the bete noire of a lot of the Hebrew Bible tradition is this caution against idolatry. And the language we use to talk about that is sin. I think a better way for contemporary people of faith to think about that is addiction. I think that's probably a better way for us to name what's being talked about here, which is not so much, did you lie to your mother? Did you steal candy from the candy shop? And did you have sex with somebody you're not married to? But like, what obsessions are you projecting onto other people or to people you don't even know in your life? As a way of, I get my sense is like as a way of assuaging some deep hurt. And we do that culturally and we do it individualistically.
Yes.
Communities do this, nations do this, and individuals are complicit, I think, in this system of addiction. And I think that's probably a better way of thinking about when the Bible talks about sin, what it's trying to adduce.
I think so, because then I agree entirely. And the thing about addiction particularly, and in both, certainly with Kris Kristofferson and Bradley Cooper characters, we have men deep into alcohol and drug addiction. And for me, the category of sin means that we behold each other in our sinfulness and without shame or blame, right? That the conflation of sin and shame and blame, I think, creates just enormous personal angst and unhelpful self-loathing, which I think is very much going on in both films. These men hate themselves, and the self-loathing, the shame that the sense of self-shame that they carry with them in a culture that is from 76 till, what was it, 2018.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's in the Bradley Cooper film where a groupie gets in the car with Bradley Cooper and says, I've got some amphetamines. One of my friends is a doctor at an ER, and I get them from him. Or was that the Christofferson?
I think that might be the Christofferson film. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. My point is, we live in a pharmaceutical culture. Mm-hmm. Right. And so is it any surprise that when human beings are feeling overwhelmed by the stress and the anxiety that is just in the air? It was in the air in 76. It was 2018. It sure is in 2024 when we're recording this. Resort to something to get out of, to relieve the anxiety. And then that thing that we get into, you know, and I speak from my own sort of history of addiction to substance and so forth, begins to get hold of us and it becomes the problem, right? This is the perniciousness of sin. Not so much that we choose the wrong thing. Yeah, we're always choosing the wrong thing. But that seeking to anesthetize, hold ourselves stable amidst an unstable world brings with it its own spiraling into behavior that shames us, that we shame ourselves. I mean, the shame that, in both the Grammy Awards in both these films, where they just embarrass themselves at the moment. I mean, I just find that heartbreaking.
It's the hardest moment, I think, in all of, in every Star Is Born. When the woman's great moment of success is completely ruined and undercut by the toxic guy. Another trajectory you can trace through these films is the way that culture has thought about and treated male addictive patterns, right? Like in 1937 and to a certain degree 1954, it's men who can't control their drinking, right? And we're not naming it as alcoholism, certainly not 1937. That's not really even a term that we have. It's they're not strong enough. Real men can drink as much as they want and still function in the morning. This is failed masculinity. And that's really the way that both the Frederick March and the James Mason character are kind of treated, right? It's a failure of masculinity. If they were real men, they would be able to drink that much and handle it. And that, you know, that becomes the tragedy, is right. Like they just couldn't take it. By 2018, certainly, when we actually see Bradley Cooper in recovery,
and
Lady Gaga as Ali comes to him and says, you really embarrassed me at the Grammys when you stood up there with me and peed your pants on national television while I was receiving my great award and trying to have my moment in the sun. You made me into a laughingstock. I also understand it's not you, it's the disease, right?
Yes. Yeah, so a beautiful moment.
It is. It's a beautiful moment. And that tells you so much about how in 2018, right, this is the script that we use, right? It's not you, it's the disease. Which, I mean, in some ways, like theologically, I think what we're saying there is it's sin. It's not – you are not irredeemably fucked up. You are caught in a system of addiction, in a system of idolatry, in a system – I mean, Paul says this beautifully. I think it was 1 Corinthians, I do not do what I want. It's the sin lurking in me. You know, it's like – to a certain degree, that can become a kind of psychological script that I think isn't all that helpful. I am powerless, right? I can't control my behavior. I don't think that's always a helpful script, certainly not for addicts. My sense is for those who are dealing with being the enablers, the victims, living around an addict, trying to figure out how to live that life. That is a helpful thing to think about, right? Like it's not the person I love; it's the disease that they have, and they are working to overcome. So I can figure out ways to support them, hopefully not enable them. That's a whole different, you know, there's a whole system around that, right? What it means to be an adult survivor of alcoholism and child of alcoholics and, you know, all of the kind of, those of us who are affected by addictive behaviors, not in ourselves, but in the people we love, and the ways in which that implicates how we are in the world. But yeah, but the way that these stories tell the story of addiction and the changing ways in which culture has understood addictive behaviors to me is fascinating. It's a really interesting window in how that framework changes.
Fascinating and important. And at some level, is it too much to suggest that we're all addicts at some level?
I think that is kind of
right.
The, yeah.
I think that is that's the point here.
That's the deep wisdom to a lot of 12-step systems, which is not the only way, you know, like there's, and yeah, there's probably not the time to get into all of the, but yeah, I think some of the deep wisdom at the heart of any contemporary way of kind of thinking through addictive behaviors is this is, some of this is what it means to be a human being, right?
Yes.
This is, there is a kind of built-in, you know, in the Christian tradition, we would say sinfulness, right? Like we are drawn to self-medication, and it doesn't have to be alcohol. It doesn't have to be drugs. It can be sex. It can be pornography.
It can be church.
Work, it can be church. It can be just about anything that will fill the emptiness, the void, whatever it is, the lack in us, and kind of turn down the volume on our existential feelings of worthlessness and shame.
Yes.
My sense is that is a way of thinking about why self-destructive behaviors continue to proliferate, have grown exponentially. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, it's like I find these films a little harder to watch now, having done so many funerals for men who killed themselves. You
yes.
know, it's like, yeah. I don't know, like there was a way in which telling stories about suicide, I mean, David O. Selznick had to really fight in 1937 to get that made. People were like, no, we can't possibly show a suicide. And they don't show it on screen. He just walks. You know, it's a very Hollywood suicide. He walks into the ocean. I'm less and less comfortable with stories. I don't think any of these films are trying to glamorize suicide. I want to be really careful about this.
Yeah.
There is a kind of Hollywoodification of suicide in these films that I find more and more problematic.
Right.
I don't know that these films help.
And both of us live in cities that are being overwhelmed by the opioid crisis and by overdose and the deaths of overdose. I mean, it's easy to say, oh, well, that's in the street identified community, that's in poverty. But in my experience, it is more and more in the middle class, amongst suburban families, perfectly people who you would never know are self-medicating, anesthetizing themselves, as you say, against these deep feelings of unworthiness. Also, I think deep feelings of hopelessness about the world in which we live. And these characters in the film, I think, both in 76 and 2018, personify some of, I mean, it kind of gets presented, particularly in Kris Kristofferson's case, as a kind of hedonism, right? Like he is just, it's the, you know, that was the beginning of the conversation about the culture of narcissism.
He's
Jim Morrison. Yeah. This is all because he's egocentric.
Right. And in the 70s, my sense, and to a certain degree today, that was kind of glamorized, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like I remember, I grew up as a kid in the 90s and people had him on their t-shirts. You know, like it was a Janis Joplin, you know, very much a kind of the self-destructive star is its own kind of idol. It's like you're not really true as an artist unless you are skating right next door to a suicide attempt. And when you actually do it, when you actually take your own life, that is kind of, you know, it's like, oh, what a tragedy. But also, I mean, it's like it's James Dean, it's Marilyn Monroe, it's Judy Garland. It's like, you know, only the good die young. There's this kind of. And that's the bit to me that, like, I don't know. It's like, is it helpful to make stories about this? I mean, to a certain degree, it's like stories are culturally, that's the way that we process stuff, right? This is how culturally, I think, we kind of figure out, you know, what's going on. You know, I remember sitting in the audience in 2018 when A Star Is Born came out and weeping, you know, it's like, there was something happening there for me. So it's like, I know this story has power. I see the way that the story gets made every 20 years in a new generation, and it has power. It's the suicide and the self-addictive stuff and the ways in which I don't trust it because these stories are being told by the very industries that depend on this script to make money. That's the thing. That really strikes me as, problematic at one level, demonic at another level.
Demonic.
It's like, is this just capitalism offering us a story that at one level it kind of knows is going to perpetuate these very cycles so that we will continue to pay money to go see a movie about it? That's the bit that I I kind of want to, I mean, certainly want to push back on, and maybe want to, like, there's a piece of me that's like, what would a radical pushback on this look like? Like, stop making this fucking story and making money off of it. You yep. are doing damage to people. I don't know. Like, I'm getting up on a high horse that I don't even trust. I don't trust this soapbox. But I do find, I don't know, maybe it's because I love these movies. You know? Like, I love these. I don't love 1973 A Star Is Born with Barbra Streisand and Christa Gofferson. I can let that one I don't find. But I do love the Bradley Cooper film with Lady Gaga. I love Lady Gaga in that film. Like, I just...
She is phenomenal.
She's incredible. She's phenomenal. Yeah. I love Judy Garland. You know, it's like, I'm a gay boy, of course. It's like I've got a thing for a Judy Garland film where she, you know, sings her heart out and then has to weep at the end of the film because her husband walks into the service. And we never actually see, you know, we don't see the drowning. Of course we don't. Drowning is a horrible way to die. We don't see it. Yeah. He walks into a fucking sunset. I don't know. Like, so I suppose the reason I get so animated about this is that I feel very complicit in this cultural addiction that I think we have to telling a story about a self-destructive star. And isn't it a shame that our celebrity-obsessed world does this to them? So we leave the theater kind of clucking our tongues and thinking, thank God that's not me. And it's me. Like that, you
it
know, it's
us.
Like,
yeah.
That's us. That is our story. And I don't know, like, I don't love the fact that we're paying money to our corporate overlords who are going to spoon-feed us this stuff over and over and over again.
Yeah, I agree. And Barbara, let's just talk about, so here she is in 1976, rocking out, right? This is Barbara moving from Dolly Levi's Victorian into being a hippie. Really, late hippie. Yeah, something there.
Or Carly Simon. I think she imagines that what she's doing is sort of like the 70s singer-songwriter, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, Carole King. That's kind of what she's trying to play, I think. Now, you know, and to a certain degree, she does it, right? She writes a song for this film. She won an Oscar for Evergreen, the song that she wrote. So, you know, she is also, I think, experimenting as an artist with what would it mean if I wrote my own material? What if I actually have something to say, right? Not just sing other people's words, but I've got music in me. I've got something to say. What happens if I bring that to the world in the way that I see women of my generation doing,
right?
Like, she's surrounded by rock stars who are doing this and getting adulation for it. And to a certain degree, as a feminist, right? Like, getting great power as a result of telling their own story, shaping their own material. I think that's very much on her mind as she's making this film.
And she writes it in her song, Woman in the Moon, like, try to look like you belong, but don't push, girl.
I was warned as a child of 13. Not to act too strong. Try to look like you belong, but don't push, girl. Save your time and trouble. Don't misbehave. I was raised in a know-you-don't world, overrun with rules. Memorize your lines and move as directed. That's an age-old story. Everybody knows that's a worn-out song. But you and I had to change that tune. Well, the woman.
I was raised in a no you don't world overrun with rules. You and I are changing that tune. We're learning new rhythms. And I think that's her kind of that's who she wants to be as Esther. Is it too much to suggest that she was thinking, somebody was thinking about Queen Esther in the
name?
Book of Esther in Hebrew scriptures, who's actually a very strong woman, right? Yep.
I mean, it would have to be Dorothy Parker. That's, I mean, or it would have to go back to the 1937, that material, because that's where that name comes from, right? In the
Esther
30s.
Esther is always there.
Esther,
yeah.
Esther Blodgett is the name of the little girl who grows up in North Dakota and comes to the big city to make it big. So that's where that name comes from. Barbara is borrowing the name. She does say in the autobiography, you know, her name was Esther Blodgett, but I'm playing this woman now. So I wanted to make her Jewish. So she's, I forget Esther Hoffman. There is a sort of element of, I'm going to take this this cultural script and make it work for me as a Jewish, powerful Jewish woman. But she keeps that name Esther. And I think that is significant. I mean,
I think it is significant.
For the sake of our podcast, let's go there. We're in the season of Purim right now, right? There's a way in which I feel like A Star Is Born is kind of a Purim spiel, a little bit. It's a story about Hadassah, Esther. Esther is in the biblical story of Esther. Esther is her Persian name, I think. That's basically the name of her corporate overlords, we might say, the name that the state gives her. Her Jewish name is Hadassah, and she is the savior of her people, right? She is the one who is married to the king for such a time. This is what her uncle Mordecai says to her, right? Perhaps you have come into the kingdom for such a time as this, right? You have a sacred role to play, Esther. Your job is to save your people from destruction. That's the story that a Purim spiel tells. It's one of the great stories of Jewish freedom and emancipation is the story of Esther, our great kind of national hero, the woman who, I mean, through marriage, was able to accrue enough power to save her people. So that's an interesting way of thinking about how this character functions in A Star Is Born, right?
Yeah.
Stars, I suppose, in this skating, are those who are put into culture for such a time as this, potentially to save their people.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, she's on a journey of transformation through grief. She's on, as you said earlier, a death and resurrection story. And somewhere in the midst of all that, she wrote Evergreen.
Evergreen. Do you like that song?
I like the melody.
Do you remember it? Do you remember when it came out and it was a chart topper? Do you remember listening?
Yeah, I remember listening.
Was it kind of in the air?
It was in the zeitgeist, but I was 76, 77. I was opposed to anything.
Yes, you were a young seminarian. I was a young seminarian. You were too cool for Evergreen.
We were listening to Steely Dan. We were listening to Little Feet. We weren't listening to Streisand.
No, in those years. She was too pop culture.
She was too pop culture. So, yeah, I remember it being around and hearing it, you know, in the film. It's a nice song.
You and I. Night of first, every day a beginning. Spirits rise, and their dance is unrehearsed. They warm and excite us, 'cause we have the brightest night. Two lights that shine as one. Morning glory and midnight sun.
It's a nice song.
It doesn't really belong in it.
No. I mean, there's a scene that got cut from the film. I think it's been restored in some version. Actually, Barbara has restored it. She restored it for Netflix. I haven't been able to track this version down. It's not on Netflix right now. But she restored the scene where the Barbra Streisand character is picking out on guitar the melody that she has written, which is Evergreen. And Kris Kristofferson says, wait a minute, that's a really good song. It's basically, my understanding is, it's basically a scene based on her experience with the songwriter, the guy who wrote the lyrics to Evergreen.
Paul Williams,
where she was just like fooling around on the guitar and was kind of embarrassed, like shared with him this little melody that she'd written. He's like, that's our love theme, right? Like, I can work with that. So basically they use that conversation. It becomes a conversation between Barbra Streisand and Kris Kristofferson in the film. But that scene got cut. So you never actually get the moment in the film until that scene gets restored that establishes for you the importance that this song has in the story, which is, this is actually...
It's their love song.
Yeah, there's sexual chemistry between these two people, sure. But really, in every iteration of this story, what brings these two together is an artistic romance first.
Yeah.
It's partnership in their shared art, right? They discover that they both think about music. And the Bradley Cooper film does this beautifully, right? There's 12 notes in an octave scale. And I think what Bradley Cooper says to Lady Gaga is, I just love the way that you see those notes, right? Like he is compelled by her artistically. And that, I think, is supposed to be what's happening in that scene between Barbra and Kris Kristofferson, right? Is that he is so compelled by her voice, by how she is musically in the world. And that's why they fall in love. That becomes Evergreen. Love, soft as an easy chair, love, breathless in the... I mean, this is where, like, I just think it's a dumb lyric, you know? Like, I can't even, like, the song, it's a pretty melody. It is kind of an interesting melody. She's very proud of it, and she won an Oscar for it, so good for her. She's the first woman to ever win an Oscar for best song. I'm so proud that she did that.
Yeah.
I wish that it was for a better song, but whatever. That's a matter of taste.
And it's that, I mean, it's that they both can hear the muse of... Yeah. Melody in their minds, and having known a number of composers over my life, these folks are quite often tormented because of hearing music in their heads and then struggling to get it out and holding it for a moment, because music is so ephemeral, right? It is here only in the moment. It's why choirs and orchestras, often the moment that the music is made most profoundly is in rehearsal, not in performance, you know, because it captures them. And every now and then, and we know this from our work in church and our love of theater, every now and then there is just a moment when the music completely envelops us and carries a moment and brings together not just emotion, it's also thought when you add text into it. So the power of the moment of two composers falling in love because they both are attuned in the same way to, you know, the music of the spheres. It's...
Yeah. Well, and that's, I think that's what Evergreen is trying to do, right? The vision that it skates of a love affair is one that I don't particularly love, right? Like every night is the first night. Like it's always so, you know, it's like we have found the deep sacredness of a love that can only, you know, it's like we're never going to not be together. Right? Like, it's always going to be fresh with you. And bullshit. Like,
yeah,
I mean, and there's sort of like the film basically tells the story of how that's impossible, right?
It's impossible.
They fight, and at the end of the day, he kills himself. So, you know, it's like, that is a vision of love that explodes in their face, as it should, as it does, I think, inevitably over the course of any long term relationship, which is that every night is actually not like the first night. That was ephemeral. Back to your kind of music metaphor, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that
yeah.
song. Doesn't necessarily come to life every time you sing it. Sometimes it's, but the film or the song, I think, is holding out this image of, boy, there is something so powerful though in those moments of synchronicity. That's what makes you feel like maybe the love can't be evergreen, but the music can. Right?
Yes.
And there is
yes.
something that, I mean, A Star is Born does sort of, you know, that's kind of where it ends. Esther's arc kind of ends. She sings his great song, Take a Look at Me Now. It's a 9-minute performance that goes on and on. And it's her in close up, and she has mixed thoughts about it now, as she should, because it's a lot. But I think what that's trying to say is, if there's a triumph, if there's resurrection in this story for Esther, it is the love affair has ended and actually was pretty toxic all the way along. But the music is pure, The music is real. That moment that they experience in the cutscene, writing the song together, that is the moment that had truth and power and beauty. And that even the horrible end of the human relationship cannot rob the music of its sacredness, we might say. And that I do find, that's pretty close to gospel.
That is pretty close to gospel. And of course, your favorite, I'm poking fun, Randy Rainbow did a great song parody of Evergreen, and it's using the words Evergreen and inserting Marjorie Taylor Greene and a takedown of MAGA, which is absolutely fun. I know you hate Randy Rainbow, but I couldn't resist at least mentioning it because I know some of our listeners, as soon as they hear Evergreen, won't think about Barbara Streisand. They'll think about...
They'll think about Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Hey friends,
I've got a question for you. Are they trying to terrorize our mindset? The gangs are holding them back.
What's happening in DC?
It beats the shit out of me nuts.
Filling the GOP. What's such nut? Marjorie Taylor Greene seldom has a clip.
It's not white people.
While these schmoes happily write her checks.
Please, I'm begging you.
She blames Muslims and satanic pizza sets.
Q is a patriot.
What the fuck, Marjorie Taylor Greene, are you going through?
What the fuck?
I don't know if that's the ultimate triumph of the religious right in America, or if that is Randy Rainbow's triumph over MAGA. We'll have to see. We'll have to live a little bit longer to see how that trajectory plays out. But here, clearly, we're working with a melody that has become, shall we say, central to the American pop identity. So it's worth paying attention to for that reason alone.
It's in the songbook.
It's in the zeitgeist. Yeah.
Well, A Star Is Born.
A Star Is Born.
I didn't know what we'd say about it, but actually, just thinking about our conversation, the notions of sin, addiction, projection, scapegoating, celebrity culture, anxiety, existential—it's got it all. It's uncomfortable. Yeah. I don't think it's Barbara's best work.
I don't
ever.
Either, but I admire her for making the film. I see why she was drawn to it. Yeah, it's, if I'm being cheap to it, it's a $6 million home movie, you know? It's her and John Peters basically putting their love affair on screens, both because they're aware that they are celebrities and people want to... In fact, you know, the article that came out that the director of the film, Frank Pearson, wrote, that Barbara refuses to read, basically, to this day. She read it, I think she read it once in Galleys, was so, I mean, understandably, right? Felt betrayed, was so angry, felt like he had thrown her under the bus, lied. She accuses him of lying, basically, right? Making things up wholesale. I went back and read a little bit of that article today. It's actually a fascinating article, like the kind of the insider view, you know, because he shows up at her ranch for the first time and basically it's the set of A Star Is Born, you know, like he's like, there's a whole garden that is being delivered on a truck bed that afternoon. It's installed by noon. And then she and John come out and start, right? Like, he's like, you know, the money is no object. Everything can happen right now. And they are aware of themselves as celebrities. They are very aware of themselves as like, and Barbara throughout the kind of creative process seems to be saying like, don't use this bit. That's us. And she says to to Frank Pearson at one point, at some point they're going to want to make a movie about me. So I want to save a lot of the good stuff for that movie. I don't want to waste it on this film, which is so interesting. I mean, the level of self-awareness that she carries as a celebrity, as a creator, aware that she is in the public eye. I don't think she particularly likes being in the public eye. I think it terrifies her. She's had horrible experiences. At the same time, she's aware that, like, as an artist, I have something to say, and this is how I say it. And, you know, and people want to hear what I have to say. I have power in this culture. I think to a certain degree, she feels a responsibility to say something. And that's why, she's really interested in telling a story about women. She's interested in telling a story about women and power and the feminist movement, because that really matters to her, both as a woman but also because she sees the women around her really struggling. And so this is, to a certain degree, I think that's, you know, that's the power of art. That's the power of the artist as a prophet, as a priest to a certain degree, right? She is basically preaching a kind of a sermon, and she's got a big pulpit to do it from. So good for her. She won an Academy Award for it, not for the performance, but for the song.
Yeah.
So there is something that I find really laudable about this film. I just don't think it's a particularly good. I don't think it's a particularly good sermon. At the end of the day,
I don't disagree at all. Well, until next time.
Until next time.
Okay.
The Gospel of Musical Theater is a production of Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland, Oregon. Join Peter and Nathan every other Friday right here in your podcast feed, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @GospelofMT. Learn more and support us at trinity-episcopal.org/podcasts. See you next time.